the General Government Subcommittee on Ways and Means to order. We are going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 5538. This is a continuation of the public hearing from yesterday. This is the Public Employee Retirement System budget. We are lacking in committee members today, for the record. That's why we started a subcommittee of the subcommittee. We have members testifying and excused today, working on various other pieces and parts of the budgets and their own personal bills. We were going to start out today regarding the backlog, but PRS has provided us a detailed written explanation of that, and we will communicate that to the members of the committee, should they have specific questions, we can either do it during work session or at some later point in time, or they can get with the agency individually to answer the questions, but we'll enter those into the record just so we've got those. Jim, you want to go ahead? I think we're on page 33 of your presentation.
Chair Patridge, happy to begin on...
you can begin on whatever page you want, Jim.
And Chair Patridge, if you'd like, I could give the subcommittee literally a three-minute explanation of the backlog issue that arose, the question that arose about our backlog initiative yesterday.
And if you'd like to clear the record on what happened yesterday, so that historically when somebody comes back and listens to this tape,
I think that would be helpful. I believe that Mr. Wyand has handed out a two-page summary document that talks about our backlog initiative and the state of the transaction backlogs. This is a highly summarized version of a much longer report that our staff has done and presented to our board. If I could counterintuitively start at the second page and then work back to the first page, there's a pie chart in the at the top of the second page that shows the size of the largest backlogs that are in our system and the percentage of the total backlogs they account for, and then the histogram below shows the absolute numbers of these various types of backlogs. One of the questions that arose yesterday was, how many hours does it take to clear a backlog item? And the answer is, it depends on the type of backlog item. We have many different varieties, and they aggregate to some very large numbers. So now if I could turn to the first page, which deals specifically with the backlog initiative that we are requesting permission to spend trust fund dollars on to eliminate. And what we've done is we've chosen three target backlogs. The employer member data backlog, where there are discrepancies between our records and employer records, or the employee's claims about what the employer record should say. And these need to be cleared in order to get accurate transactions. So one of these, that is one of the various kinds of backlogs that we're targeting in 0305. The second one is required minimum distribution on death. This is important because it represents a financial risk to the system. And the same thing with no pay. So we've picked three of the many kinds of backlogs. And as you can see, the number of hours per backlog clearance that we're estimating, and it is an estimate and it is an average, differ. One is 6 hours, one is 5 hours, and the last one is an hour per closure. And the nut of the question that Senator Winters raised yesterday was, how do you get 11 FTE to attack these three backlogs? And the answer is, we take these three backlogs, the size of the backlogs, our estimate of the hours, back them into a total number of hours in the 0305 biennium, and we come up with approximately 11 FTE. And knock on wood, we think we can come very close, if not wiping out these backlogs by the end of the biennium, these particular categories in the backlogs. So that's the summary of the question that came up yesterday.
Jim, I just want to make sure, though, with your current staffing, you're obviously stacking up some of these backlogs along the way. So we're going to give you the FTE to eliminate part of the backlog, but will that also, do you also anticipate that that will keep your backlogs in a manageable fashion? So that we won't be continuing to stack up additional backlogs. I just want to make sure if we're giving you staff that we give you the adequate staff in order to maintain the system so that we're not back next time?
Chair Patridge, that is an excellent question, and the answer is one of the reasons that I'm hedging about totally wiping out these backlogs is precisely your question. If you notice on the first page, on the first backlog category that we handed out, when we built this budget a year plus ago, the backlog of employer member data discrepancies was 6,000. Currently, it has already grown to 7,400. So in point of fact, if we achieved exactly what we thought we'd do, we'd end up with 1,400 uncleared items in this backlog, even if you permitted us to spend trust fund assets on the 11 FTE that we're asking for. And in addition, because of the surge of retirements as is currently happening, the backlog is growing, and I'm saving that discussion at the request of Chair Butler to the end of the meeting. So there is a very grave risk that that we won't wipe out these backlogs even if we have the 11 FTE. But that doesn't mean that we can't improve the data accuracy of the system mightily in this.
So you're preparing something for Representative Butler or a discussion towards the end on this particular issue?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Then I will not delve into this any further, and we'll let the Chair delve into that as he sees fit.
Representative Patridge, I just want also to add that the Governor's budget includes Package 105, which is an ongoing workload capacity package.
There right.
4.5 FTE, so although it is not directly linked to the specific backlogs here, it is intended to help with not continuing
stem
to build
their
up.
Growth.
Right.
All right.
If I could move on to page 34, we talked about the backlogs here, and I don't know that, that it bears too much repeating. The data accuracy issue, the backlogs were intended to be packaged as separate items because we have found that the backlogs and accuracy have always taken a back seat to current operations. And what we didn't want to do was leave our stakeholders or the legislature sort of ignorant of what was happening because they were being masked by being shoved underneath the current operations of the system. So part of our strategic plan was to separate them out as individual targets. I don't know that that you care to or want to go through each of the pages in the backlog item. We can if you want to. One of the things I did want to say about...
I don't think it's necessary to go through each of the pages.
I do want to...
Unless Senator Devlin wishes to delve into it.
No, Mr. Chairman, the only thing I would say is that obviously a lot of the backlog has probably been precipitated, at least some of it, it's increased by the discussion of mortality tables, and when that decision is finally settled, there'll probably be some more retirements, but at the same time, that probably will not lead to a huge increase. But depending upon what we do in 2003, they could see a substantial additional bump in terms of people leaving the system.
Chair Patridge, Senator Devlin, I couldn't agree more. I would say one thing, you are correct that the current additions to the backlog are mightily affected by the uncertainty over policy in the system and the surge of activity in our membership. But in the larger backlog report, I actually asked our staff to create a vintage sort of sense for these backlogs. And as I mentioned yesterday in my testimony, some of them date back as long ago as the early 1990s. And so this problem has been building sort of underneath without being bared for some time. And so, yes, the current circumstances are aiding and abetting it, but some of the vintages are actually quite old. The other thing I wanted
to say... Have they gotten any better, like fine wine?
No, they're turning to vinegar. The other thing I wanted to say about that related to a question that the committee raised yesterday about data accuracy and our initiative there is that we are in an awkward period where we have an extraordinary reliance on manual processes, literally paper and pencil, filling out sheets, and having them checked by somebody else. This is putting a stress on our span of control in the sense that we have too little supervisory review. This was raised yesterday in asking one of the questions about why we have so many lead workers or supervisors. And part of it is this time-intensive supervisory capacity in order to try to get closer to one and done, which is high productivity. Again, our long-term strategic goal is not to do that. Our long-term strategic goal is to have, in essence, automated audit trails of our transactions so that they can be checked in the same way that the IRS checks the most simple of tax forms. They do it electronically, and the questionable ones are kicked out, and only those get actual manual review. But we're a number of years away from that. And again, that is one of the reasons why our FTE requests so heavily stress limited duration. It's a hopeful sign on our part that if we are successful over the next 3 to 5 years in building out our self-auditing automated capacity, we won't need so many people.
But that doesn't deal with the principal exec positions.
That is correct, Chair Patridge. Again, that partly is driven, as I said yesterday, by our desire to use outsourcing in as many places as possible. And so you would have a manager, but their staff would not be on the public payroll. So you'd see many more managers than you might think. Also, it's the proliferation of individual programs within the PERS system. While the PERS retirement system is our largest program by far, we actually, as was discussed yesterday, have many individual programs with individual statutory basis. So if I could turn to page 37 and talk a little bit about what Cora mentioned earlier, and that is that to try to address ongoing capacity constraints. This is working on current workload where we're finding constraints that tie up or make us less productive than we could otherwise be. So now we've moved away from backload and accuracy, and we're focusing on where the constraints to productivity are. Largely the personal service or customer service side of our business, we have instituted video conferencing, something that the legislature 2 years ago in this particular room directed us to implement, and we have done so with some success and with the help of the state agencies overall. We also are looking to make that permanent as part of our activity. The second thing is a phone system upgrade. When we moved to our new building, how many years ago was that?
It was
1997. We actually physically took a sawzall and cut the phone switch out of the old building in Portland and carried that phone switch to the new building and sort of wired it in. It's quite old, and it limits very much our ability to use our phone system to try to allow members to do more self-help and to track what they're doing so that we can have resources optimally deployed. And so one of the things that we'd like to do is to upgrade the phone system. We think it will be very helpful both in terms of raising the productivity of the staff, but also improving membership with a one-time capital investment rather than more people. And the other is, and it's not something that we're asking for budget or FTE for, I don't believe, is staffing flexibility. We have instituted a process where we flex staff across divisions. It's not always the most popular thing, I must say, at the agency, but we have moved people around to try to meet workload peaks where we can. And one of the things that we're doing now is, and you'll hear later, is we want to make the business rules coordinator a permanent position, because our ability to document our business rules allows us to do much more thorough cross-training, and that aids the ability to flex people from division to division. There's so much specialized knowledge that right now our ability to do that is constrained.
Jim Patridge?
I just wonder, Jim, Has PERS set standards for local jurisdictions to transmit the data on? I mean, my concern is that, first answer that question.
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, in some cases the answer is yes. In other cases the answer is an absolute no. We have standards, but the question is enforcing them. For example, in our annual reconciliation, we have January 15th date for employers to report. As of this year, I believe there are about approximately 25 to 30 employers who have still not reported to us their payroll or their contributions or their hires or their separations. Our ability to discipline them is a $2,000 fine. So,
do you ever impose any of those, Jim?
Yes, we do.
And employers must pay them. You know?
Yes, they must.
Do you have a policy of letting them know far enough in advance that it's costing the system and you're going to charge them?
Yes, we do, sir.
They just pay the $2,000. Maybe it's not enough. Representative Patridge, follow up.
I guess that's part of my question. I'm interested to know if you have chronic employers who have inaccuracy reporting problems. And in addition, are there ways to optimize the information that PERS receives as a result of setting some standards as well as timely and competent reporting? I mean, I'd rather see them do $2,000 a day until they get it in or something like that. So that your job is hard enough, and it's only costing the rest of the employers in the system more money, I would imagine.
Integrity of the system.
And the entire integrity of the system if people don't report properly.
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, I appreciate those sentiments, and I would really like to think that $2,000 a day would clear up the problem. But the fact is that we are...
$2,000 a day now?
No,
or the $2,000
period? It's $2,000. But the fact of the matter is that I'd like to think that would solve the problem, but it isn't, because the problem is really partly ours and partly the inherent complexity of the program and partly the difficulty our employers find themselves in. We get from a group of human resources managers that we've polled that the payroll staff that is responsible for calculating PERS contribution rates according to our relatively complex rules and getting them accurate and getting the documents in on time have about a 50% turnover in the last biennium. So we're talking about a huge continuing knowledge gap about our requirements and their knowledge of how to fulfill them. And we also don't help matters at all because our IT system is so weak, people cannot report to us in electronic fashion with the exception of a handful of employers. So I have to say that this is a joint problem. The handful of employers who simply we can't get to report, that's one issue, but the bigger productivity problem is that we're getting bad data, and it's a joint responsibility. We have to point the finger of blame at ourselves, too.
Follow-up, Representative Patridge?
But I guess my question, we know you're doing your computer upgrade. Is that going to help? Are there standards enough that will be set in that you're receiving common data from employers as they upgrade their systems, as they do those kinds of things? It doesn't do me a lot of good for the integrity and accuracy of the system to upgrade your computer systems and then not have the rest of the systems out there. I know the chair does. He's a local government guy, but I sometimes worry that if we don't set some minimal standards, that we really can't make it work.
Representative Patrick, that's a point well taken. I just want to report that our oldest daughter attended a payroll class this past week here in the community college system. I think it was through the community college system here in Salem. Came up from Grants Pass, and she was surprised that there were a number of community payroll clerks from cities and other municipal agencies that were in on these programs, and that these folks, many of them were new payroll clerks for their particular districts, and they've just been doing the same thing for 20 years, and they don't know the reason why. And that's kind of scary in some respects, particularly when we've got a PERS system that is significantly different than what it was 20 years ago. So I guess, you know, there's probably a training that we need to make sure that folks get into, and maybe that's an issue that should be taken up through our community colleges, and a training should be offered on behalf of municipalities relating to that for the hundreds of participants that you've got. Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to belabor this point too much, but is part of the reason the complexity that's been built into the system, in the sense of, I can think of just one thing almost immediately, is that with school districts and with state employees, we have a single rate because liability is shared. There are about 200 cities in the state, several hundred special districts, 36 counties, and although we've started to voluntarily pool, they started to voluntarily pool their liabilities, it means you've got to literally have hundreds and hundreds of different rates that are computed, which I think part of the thing is we build such complexity into the system. Probably that complexity won't be in a successor system.
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, I can't resist but following up on two comments that you made. First of all, you're correct. The complexity is the heart of the problem, and it's part of the reason why we're partly to blame, and their difficulty in coping with, on the employer side, with our complexity is also partly the issue. Even the local employers who have pooled, because their past experience is firewalled off as separate from the pool, they will have different rates for the next 26 years, even though they're pooled now with the state and ed. And with respect to Chair Butler's comment about employer training, this budget initiative, I believe it's in the accuracy initiative, contains an employer, is it an inaccuracy? Complaint has a request for some resources for the first time to actually send a team out and do seminars with employers to try to raise the accuracy rate of the data they transmit at the source, so that at PERS we're not working with very high error rates that, quite frankly, you know, we're jointly at fault for creating. But it's a productivity gain if we can get it at the source right then and there.
Dallas, you want to respond to that?
If I may follow up with a question, then, Mr. Chair. If these resources are granted, these seminars or this training opportunities are provided to employers, do you plan then to track those employers' submissions to see if it's worked or if it's not, or if they're just ignoring it and continuing on their merry way and still causing you problems?
Chair Butler, Mr. Wine, absolutely. In fact, we track their annual reconciliation error rates now. They're called exceptions. We keep a running database that starts at their submission on January 15th through the closure of the annuals process in April, and the submission and the delivery of member statements. We actually calculate the number of exceptions they've had in their reporting and our staff's resolution of them. One other comment that was raised in the question, which was the successor system, with the legislature already working on a successor system and some actual structures being discussed, we have already begun advanced planning on that. And I can tell you that people, if the successor system is as simple as the structures that are now being discussed before the legislature, folks will be startled at the simplicity and the accuracy of employer reporting that I believe we'll be able to institute after the startup, because we already have plans to go to over-the-web submission of data from employers, including the smallest district. All they need is a PC and an internet connection, and they will have active, screen-active forms that they can fire and forget at us. And it will be so startlingly different than the current system that I think the successor system will show that that complexity is really the cause of the data problem that exists between us and employers.
Senator Devlin?
I don't want to get into this in too much depth in this committee, but if you have a successor system, it depends upon how that successor system is structured in terms of would you have a melded rate, because you will obviously still have employees under the you could still have employees, depending upon what's being discussed.
You still could have employees.
under the old system. So would you have a melded rate, or would you...
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, that's an implementation matter that you could go one way or the other. It's clear that the costs that employers are obligated to pay under the old system have to be paid. It is quite often that those are expressed on a per capita basis, including new system and old system people, but it doesn't have to be that way. And the rate itself is probably not going to be the source of the main source of complexity. The main source of complexity is the multiple membership categories and tiers, and our own IT limitations, and the way we have to get data that is restricted by our own IT limitations.
President Patridge?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I'm still trying to get down to the error rate issue, Jim. I don't know how much of the calculation is done. I mean, you're getting a certain amount of raw data from the employers. And generally, you're probably making the calculation, I would assume. I mean, they're making some calculations, obviously. But you're generally making the calculations. So what I'm trying to understand is, when we look at these error rates that are out there, on the computation at 15%, how much of that is accountable to PERS, and how much of that is accountable to the raw data that you're getting from the local employers? And that's what I'm trying to, you know, the error rate's one thing, but the data that you're getting to employers is another issue.
I don't have, Chair Butler or Representative Patridge, a really solid answer for you, because these errors come into the stages of the process in many ways. But we do have one piece of data I could offer you, and that is, at the very start, the year's reconciliation of the past year's payroll and contributions, we typically have between 20 and 25,000 data errors that are then methodically sorted out.
Data errors coming in from?
Coming in, that's right, where... Our analysis shows that number is suspect, isn't likely to be right. And then our staff literally gets on the phone with employers and goes back and forth, and we have manila folders, and eventually these exceptions are what we call cleared, until we get to the point where the data is clean enough that we allow it into our database.
But I guess my question is, so if you have 25,000 pieces of data that are electronically sorted and come in as flawed or suspect or whatever term you want to use. So, but I guess my question is, what's causing that particular piece of data? Is it antiquated systems at the local level? Is it lack of training? Is it, I mean, I'm trying to understand, you know, we all bear a burden in this together, whether we're a special district or a local jurisdiction out there.
And Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, we don't, it's all of those things, but we don't know in what order. We know that those we would call employer reporting errors. But the source of them at the employer level, we're not sure. The next level of errors we've talked about yesterday, which are the benefit calculation errors, those are predominantly our errors in manual processes. However, some subset of those are errors because we're working with bad data, and then we eventually find the correct data and have to fix them. But I don't want to dump on our employers here, because I'm very sensitive to the fact that we put some hellacious burdens on them in terms of having their payroll staff understand our complex system. And I would not want our 865 employers to come away thinking that PERS came in here and said they were a problem.
But I guess, Mr. Chair,
please follow up.
Well, I guess my question, I mean, you have the 9,000 backlog requests that I'm looking at. So 6,000 of those need to be research, documentation, and correction. I assume that some portion of that is going back to the employers to make sure the data that they supplied was correct.
All of them require that.
Yeah, so if that's costing the state and employer rates 11 FTEs to clear up that backlog data, plus whatever it takes to go on an ongoing basis, I'm trying to, you know, and maybe we need to look at a budget note or have them come back. I don't know if they can do this time or at this point in time, but I need to know if the data, if we need to hold local governments more accountable, I need to know that. I mean, I'm not going to go dump on local government. I came from local government, too. I don't want to dump on them. But you know, if they're not investing in the systems to maintain accurate information, it shouldn't be the state and the rest of the employers in the state's burden to make up for the errors, lack of standards, lack of training that these other people are having. It should frankly be the cost of the employers who are providing the bad data.
And that's the concern that I have of having a system-wide program to go out and train employers. Really, those employers who continually have problems need to go ahead and be assessed for any training directly. And then that assessment directly to those. If the city of Portland or some other Multnomah Fire District is doing a great job of reporting, I hate to assess those folks to go out and take care of the city of Timbuktu because those folks have reporting problems. I believe that it ought to be pay as you go, and if they're not willing to invest in staff that are willing to work with your staff to get you the correct information, then that training should come at their expense.
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, could I make a suggestion? And it's along the lines of what Mr. Wyand said earlier. If the legislature looks favorably on our investing some modest resources in videos, training materials, and some seminars, it's mostly going to be the former, not traveling around the state. If the legislature looks favorably on that, I think what we could do is embed as part of that effort a before and after. Is it making any difference? We could focus on some selected employers where we make some special efforts as a test case, and we could look at our system-wide data flows and see if it makes sense. We may come back in the next biennium and say, this made such a big effort that we don't need these 11 people anymore for this accuracy initiative. We need two to do more of this employer assistance, if you will.
St. Patrick?
What I'd be interested in, Jim, and tell me if this is a large problem. I know you guys are being asked daily for information. I know you're swamped with information. But I believe in a pay-as-you-go piece. I mean, we've done that with the Attorney General's office and all the other items that we have errors and other things in state government, at least. I'm interested to know, of the 25,000 data errors that were submitted by local jurisdictions, if you can tell me by percentage, if there's some, you know, what maybe the tiers are, are some jurisdictions having 10% data error rate, other districts having, you know, 2%, other districts having whatever. So that way we have a record. If we decide that we're going to go out and do the training, we can ask you to focus on those districts with the most training. And then if we come back, you know, we can communicate to the public out there that we're looking at a pay-as-you-go system. If these districts are not going to, or we may do it this time, but a pay-as-you-go system for error rates, so that if you have error rates over, you know, data error rates over 5%, we're going to charge you.
Chair Butler, Representative Patridge, I believe by tomorrow.
None of the local government folks are here. I was hoping that some of them would be here.
We can use the current reconciliation that is actually coming to a close and give you at least some data on that. I don't think it's going to be quite the level of specificity like which districts, but we, for example, we can tell you who reported on time and who didn't, who reported a month late and who hasn't reported at all. That will give you some sense of it. And then we can give you some data on the error rates that we're discovering, for example, in the re-reporting of historical data for the Young case, which we've kept careful track of. So we can give you some flavor for that. That's about the best we could do in the context of this budget hearing, and we'd be happy to do it.
Well, I guess what I'm interested in is, can you give me a list of member organizations and say, based on the number of employees, this percentage of employees, there were data error rates. So it's 5% of their total, you know, is that?
We'll make our best efforts to do so.
Jim, are you using some kind of a computerized data input that's common amongst all of the 865 employers?
Chair Butler, we have standard forms and standard data fields. But our ability to receive data in our somewhat antiquated system, and also our employers vary, as you know, being from a part of the state that has a lot of special districts and smaller political jurisdictions, their ability to generate data electronically varies all over the lot.
So you have a paper format that they can move through.
In fact, that's our main format. Our main format for getting much of this data is our fax machine.
So my first question: do you have a computer format that it comes in? Really, it doesn't come in on a diskette, do you? It's coming in by fax machine.
For some people, it comes in on diskette, but again, we have to accommodate everybody from Rogue River Irrigation District to Multnomah County in Portland. Multnomah County has a computer system that, from what I've read about it, is far superior to ours. Rogue River District or some special districts have very limited PC capabilities in many cases, and that's one of the reasons why we're very anxious to, if a successor system is put in place, to simultaneously put reporting across the net, because then everybody will have the same capability of delivering data to a select.
We have similar issues with regard to electric control agents and the OLCC, but fortunately, the folks who sell about 95% of all of the product that pushed through the OLCC presently are on computer programs which are totally compatible with the computer program of the host. And that's still, of the 234 agents, that still leaves it about 134 agents that don't have either any kind of a computer program that they can do it on, and still doing it by paper. But fortunately, it's only just a tiny fraction of the total production. And I guess I am very concerned that you'd still be doing a lot of fax work and paper work. Correct, Ken Patrick?
I guess, and that's my question, Mr. Chair, is that, you know, with where we're at in this. I understand we try and accommodate local government, but by the same token, it's costing us a lot of staff and FTE. I mean, and I don't know, even with an antiquated computer system and database system, I would assume that you can import in just about anything in a standard format. Maybe you can't. But my question is, when are you going to standardize, and when you make it available, are you going to stop the fax machine paper piece and actually set some standards? I know some of these people scream like a mashed cat, but I'm interested in setting some standards, because the more times it's handled, the more chance you have for error.
Department of Employment and Internal Revenue Service didn't give anybody any choice as to how, and the Secretary of State does the same thing with regard to campaign CNEs. Those reports must be done on computer by a certain date, or you're no longer a candidate, I guess. I'm not sure what they do. John Porter, or just what? Senator?
Mr. Chairman, just... Or you're fined, actually, is what it comes out to. You're either on time or you're fined.
You're on time with their system.
Or you're fined.
Or you're fined. And so the bottom line is that if they don't come up to speed, then you're fined. Is this a voice of experience, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, it's a voice of experience of one minor fine over about two decades in public office, but it's a voice of experience from serving two sessions on the Rules Committee and revising half of those statutes. So.
Mr. Chair, that's what I'm interested in is, I know it's a pressure issue for you guys to try and get along with your members, but as the legislature, sometimes we can supersede or make sure that those things are foregone. I'm interested in your timeline on what, when you're going to go totally electronic and not allow local jurisdictions to put it on paper.
What percentage?
If your plan's not to do that, I want to know that so that maybe we can assist you in your effort.
And what percentage are we right now that's electronic, Jim?
Chair Butler, I don't know the answer to that for sure, but when we report tomorrow, we'll give you the,
okay.
the categories.
Yeah, I'd like to know if like the OLCC, that, you know, yeah, it may be only 100 of the 865 employers that have absolute disket capacity or other transmission capacity of the information, but that 100 may represent 99% of all of the transactions, and that would be most gratifying to hear. That in effect, you're left with such a minute portion that, and if the Owyhee Drainage Company can't report to you, they're one or two employees on a diskette format. I suppose that I'm not going to be terribly upset over that. I know that that's more work for you folks, but if it's only one or two employees per year, then that's a whole lot less issue than 30,000 or 40,000 employees overall.
Again, Chair Butler, I just want to stress again how much of this is a problem that is not just the employers, but it's ours too.
We really want to put a
big piece of this on our shoulders.
Yeah, I sure hate to go out and start fining folks for not having the information on time when we couldn't use it when it was arriving on time anyway. I think that would be it.
I agree, and I think a lot of employers would say that that our service to local employers in particular is far too low, and I wouldn't disagree with that, and that's why I don't want to leave the impression that this is bad participating employers sort of not doing their job. A lot of this rests on our shoulders, and I don't want to leave any other impression.
Okay, please continue, Jim.
I believe we're on page 38, which kind of summarizes the roadmap in terms of what we're trying to do. And if you look at the center bar, you'll see the structure, if you will, of the initiatives that are in our budget. You know, the notion of meeting the current upsurge in operational requirements and halt the growth of backlogs, knock on wood. The accuracy initiative is number 2, going down the center column. 3, reduce the backlogs. And 4, make some long-term IT improvements. We'll be discussing IT a little bit more later. As Chair Butler knows and Mr. Wyand, our IT capital spending for projects is not is something that is conducted sporadically when we approach the legislature. The one part of IT that is in the 0305 budget relates to the strengthening of internal staff to execute those projects, and I do want to talk about that a little bit later. What are we doing to try to hold down costs? Pretty much everything we can think of. We find, as the first bullet point says, that a lot of our cost containment opportunities are blocked because we can't automate, or we either the time to automation, or the difficulties of taking our own antiquated system and trying to change it effectively are probably single biggest inhibition to cost control. We do have very close monitoring of our activity costs at the activity level, as we discussed yesterday, through the use of the cost effectiveness measurement survey. So we really feel we have a handle on what we spend for many of the sort of main activities we do on a per activity basis and how it compares to our peers. Our in-state travel, you know, we have expanded our use of video, and in particular, as you recall the last presentation, the legislature asked us in very strong terms to move away from individual member counseling and go to telephone call center and group counseling. And we have done so with a vengeance, and in fact, group presentations now are the norm for everybody save for those severely disabled or with extremely complex divorce proceedings, where if we don't get in and actually sort out what's going on a direct basis, it's not going to work. We also have worked with DAS on utilization of our couple of vehicles, and we have scaled back substantially our administrative rule hearings that we hold around the state. And we know that is an issue with our stakeholders in some respects, because as you know from reading the newspapers, if nothing else, the board over the last couple of years has instituted a lot of very controversial and high-profile rulemakings. And we have restricted increasingly so the public hearings to Salem or Tigard, and sometimes just Tigard. That's not something that sits all that well with our stakeholders around the state, but it is something that has helped us curtail costs. The attorney general fees, there's good news and bad news there. Let me give you the bad news first. The bad news is that litigation continues. The Lipscomb case is now moving into its second phase, which is stays, appeals, movement to appellate court. There's lots of negotiation going on between the attorneys for the interveners, the plaintiffs, as well as the board's own attorneys. So I can't say that the activity that's being generated from litigation, which is our largest single budget cost, is that there's very good news on that. The better news is that the development of the policy group, the small policy group that the legislature supported us in, inside PERS, has allowed us to dramatically reduce the routine inquiries that we relied on DOJ for in the past. Some of them, which were nothing more than, in some respects, checkups on issues that we believe we could, by researching past attorney general opinions, get a good sense of what was a reasonable course of action. In addition, this particular group also works directly with the litigation group and our general advisors of DOJ to hone questions such that we only have to ask them once. In some cases, we can get them answered verbally rather than go through the entire process of a formal written opinion. So I think this is one of the big success areas. I just wish it was not covered or masked over by the fact that litigation continues, and in fact, more litigation is, as you know, threatened. We've been told that when the rates go into effect in July, by stakeholders, that we should expect another potentially much broader suit against the board with respect to the decisions that led up to the July rates. Whether that will come to pass and people will follow through with those filings, I can't say. Administrative costs on page 40. Again, this is where we get into the depth of the cost-effective management services that we do purchase and how helpful they are. What their annual survey this past year concluded is really the following. We have one of the most complex systems among all of the systems that they cover because of our multiple tiers, wide variety of benefit and retirement options, the hybrid nature of the system, its connection to the capital markets. They also say that we provide a lower overall level of service to members than our peers. They also say that our costs are somewhat higher than our peer group, and they attribute this to our system complexity, not any sort of misalignment or misdeployment of our resources. If you look at the charts on page 41, what you can see is, first on the upper left-hand side, that our costs are about two-thirds of the way up the scale of the comparators that they use. You can see on the next one over on the top row that our service level is about one-third from the bottom. And however, with respect to complexity on the far right-hand side, there's only one other system in their comparator universe that they see as potentially more complex than ours. And I believe they blind the survey, but I believe it's the New York State system. As you can see, our volume of work is slightly above average. That's in the lower left-hand corner of the chart. And the cost environment that we operate in is slightly lower than the average cost environment that our competitor systems work in. The bottom line, I think, is pretty clear. The cost driver for our system is complexity. On average, we're doing a pretty decent job. We don't appear, by the comparisons of this third party, to be providing services that are even average compared to our peers, and we don't say that because we're lobbying to provide more services. We'll provide the services that the legislature directs us to, but we want to give you a sense of where the service levels that you have, in essence, directed us through your budget decisions and through the statute to provide, where they rank relative to other states. And again, this is a third-party analysis. We have nothing to say about this other than to provide our own inputs for our own system. If we could turn to page 42, what you're going to see here is, I think, what of most interest is the ratio of administration costs or administrative costs to all costs. And are administrative costs, do they include litigation costs?
Yes, they would.
And I think, as you recall from e-board hearings, that our litigation costs have skyrocketed in 2001-03. That's one of the reasons why you see the fairly large jump in the administrative to total cost ratio. And knock on wood, in 2003-05, that ratio is going to go back down and may even be lower than it was as far back as 95-97. But I caution, we're not projecting in here any costs for new lawsuits or maybe continuation of these lawsuits onto the Supreme Court. So I don't want to raise any expectations. This is how it looks if nothing happens except the governor's budget. But I have to acknowledge that there's many sort of ugly dogs in the junkyard out there in terms of things that could happen to our budget. And I think one of the things we talked about yesterday that you inquired about is on page 43, and that's the ratio of our administrative positions to all positions in the agency. And as you can see, it has crept up. It will come down again in the governor's balanced budget. And I want to stress again what I said yesterday, that my experience tells me that that what we should be targeting in the long run, and I don't mean this biennium or even next biennium, but a system that relies heavily on capital infrastructure, that is good IT infrastructure, with a smaller number of people, skilled people running it and using the machines to do the record keeping that we now use lots of individual bodies to do. That's going to be more efficient and more accurate, but we can't get from here to there in a biennium or even two biennia. It's going to take more time than that, and in the meantime, our reliance on staff and FTE is higher than is optimal and higher than I would like. But not to do it is to decide not to do the job. You can see on page 44, you get a sense of what our agency is really like. We're like a gigantic pipeline, and our administrative costs are the pipe itself, the thin piece of metal that goes around, and our true financial functions are the fluid that runs through the pipe, and those are benefits and contributions, and they run both ways.
Jim, can I ask a question going back to the historical ratio of administrative and program staff? Back in 95-97, we were about 1 in 10, and now we're about 1 in 7. What would it take to get us back to the 1 in 10 ratio?
My sense is that it would take some very significant and successful IT development. And even that would be a necessity to do that, because what would happen is two things. We would then reduce the number of staff that we have doing manual processes, and that would tend to raise the ratio, but at the same time, we might be able to have a single manager do more than one program if they were well supported by automated tools that, in essence, produced the information that told them where they needed to inject their supervisory capabilities. I would liken it to a nuclear power plant. Nuclear power plants don't have that many people actually operating them at any one time. But if you go into the control room, it's a mass of instrumentation that tells a few highly skilled people what's going on and where they need to focus their attention.
I guess I would look at that, though, and see where the governor's recommended budget at 254 compares to the 182, and that's that 70 employee increase is nearly a third increase, and I'm not sure what have we gone downhill that far in our inability to handle the documentation. I certainly know that the program is that many years older, 5 years older, 7 years older. But have we moved backwards that far, Jim?
That is one of the functions, Chair Butler, are the number of manual processes that has grown over time. For example, double lump sum is a new program that was put in place. It's going to have to be done manually. We will have to, for several years, if we do a look back, as currently HB 2004 requires us to, have a very large jump in manual and transactions that have at least some manual component. So that's part of it. The other part of it is the system is growing. Its membership is expanding, and the number of participating employers is expanding, and there are some data in the back that we can show you on that. And the complexity continues to expand. I'll give you an example. In one of the special sessions last summer, the legislature decided to, in essence, carve out an entirely new category of account, lump sum accounts, contributed by employers who did pension bonds, and created a new set of crediting rules for them. And in fact, at your committee yesterday, you heard another amendment that would further add to the differentiation of those flows by, taking any administrative cost burden for the general administration of the system off of those. That's just an example of the expanding complexity of the system. Each one of those requires us to write rules, put some attention on it, and increases the supervisory obligation. In this case of Dale's division, the Fiscal Services Division, to make sure that that crediting is done properly according to the unique set of rules that just applies to those particular dollars from those particular employers.
Okay, so if between 1995-97 excuse me, and the current time, total number of public employees has gone up 5,000 a year. I don't know. Would that be... I guess we could look at that and say that's for each workday, that's what, 100? Is that 100?
Well, actually, in 1997, our membership was 253,000. It's now just under 302,000. So that's a 40-some thousand.
50,000. From 253 to 302 is 51,000. Divided the 51,000 by the, let's call it 6 years. That's 8,500, and divide that up by 220 workdays per year. That's 38 per day. 253,000 versus 302,000. That's 50,000, 49,000. And we said divide that by 6 years is 8,167 per year, and divide that up by 220 workdays is 37 new employees per year, per day.
Recognizers.
New members, right. And I don't know how many it takes to enter 37 names and addresses and so forth. And I assume that should be standardized. But let me just ask a question. I've got several questions I passed back and forth regarding IR&D issues here at the dais. But let me just ask this question. If I'm the city of fill in the blank, and I have just hired a new employee, one of these 37 employees per day, per workday, and I've transmitted a standard transmittal form to you folks, and assume that I've had to input it into my accounting system, my payroll system, totally, and that you have to do the same thing. You have to that there is no transmission of information electronically, which I'd be very disappointed if at least the state of Oregon didn't have an electronic transmission of the same information, but I don't know. excuse me, will you have to start entering information? Do your people have to start entering information by hand immediately on that employee?
Not necessarily immediately. You're exactly right in your analysis. We would get a what's called an NOE, or Notice of Employment. And then the clock would start ticking, for example, on the rules that are in the statute associated with eligibility for PERS membership. And the rules would start ticking as with respect to during what pay period a contribution could be started. Et cetera, et cetera. The number of rules that begin to apply to a person once they join begin to then expand. Are they Tier 2, or are they a returning Tier 1 employee, for example? Are they in a special category? A judge, a legislator, PNF. I mean, so yes, data starts being entered right away. I can't say that it's all by hand specifically. I'd have to go back and research that. But the record keeping begins and begins expanding the moment somebody signs on to a public employer. I did want to say one other thing, Chair Butler, and that is if you look at the 254, I do want to stress very heavily that there are over 30 of those people that are limited duration in this budget, and they are targeted at, we hope, one-time tasks, or at least one time for this biennium. So we do not make no promises about what the future holds, because I can't foretell the future, but with respect to the 0305 budget, over 30 of these bodies are targeted at specific finite tasks, like the reduction of the backlogs, improvement of our accuracy. Those jobs are not, we're not asking them to be made permanent. We're asking to be held accountable for some accomplishment at the end of the biennium for those bodies. So I think comparing the 254 to 180 is a little bit apples to oranges.
I appreciate that, because you have that includes, but I'm going to guess that, you know, as I work through this process, that person who is entering the 37 new data entries per day was on hand, was part of my staff and I'm not examining the number of staff that you got as much as I am just I needed to know kind of what the workload was to enter one new employee, and a local city enters a new employee, a 28 year old fresh from the construction industry into the sewer plant at the city of Silverton or wherever, and how much handwork. First of all, the person who's entering that data, I assume, would have been entering data or a same position, was entering the data in 1995. And I divide that up, 37 new data entries per workday, divide that by 6 hours, that's 6.2 entries per hour. It'd be one every 10 minutes, approximately, to enter in. And I assume that they would sit down and do it and be checked somehow to make certain, some sort of verification equipment. Again, that assumes that it's not arriving to you already in a format where it's just loaded into your system. But I guess I'm anxious about what I'm seeing there. Once that's done, it must create a huge amount of immediate handwork relative to that employee. And I don't know what calculations, because the next report that I get from the city of Silverton will be, and I assume they don't transmit the data until that person starts to be part of the qualified payroll. I don't know. Is that right?
I believe, Chair Butler, that they have to begin submitting payroll data, even though not contribution data. We have to know their payroll status. We could actually give you, we could come back and give you a step-by-step about what happens.
Well, and I think that, and because we are fortunate to have Dallas here who assists with the DES-RMD portion of it, I think that that's important. And again, that doesn't speak to any of the 254 employees that you've got today as much as it does a data entry person that was amongst the 180.82 people. But I'm just concerned about the amount of handwork that's required for each new hire out within the market. And you know, this person, when they come in on Monday morning, they're going to have another 37 new data entries to make that particular day, too. So,
I understand your question, Chair Butler, and your concern, and we'll try to give you a picture of that. One of the things I do want to say, though, is that if you look at 50-some thousand increase from 95 to the present time, that understates how many notices of employment and separations occur, because we have lots of people who join the public sector for 2 or 3 years and then leave. So, in fact, just looking at a point-to-point underestimates how many flows into and out of membership we actually have. But, again, I'm not... My purpose here is not to try to justify these 254 bodies on any one particular task.
Right.
If we can convey a sense that there's a portion of them that are targeted toward finite tasks that we think simply we can't put off any longer. We've put them off for, you know, 15 years.
And maybe, Jim, maybe we could end just a few minutes early today, and then you and Dallas and I could just visit about what that looks like, because I am getting just a little bit anxious about the concern that if we've got 865 employers out there, that some of them have been sloppy in the way that they've reported, or that they, you know, haven't been as diligent as they should have been, and maybe we haven't been as diligent as we should have been in insisting that the information come into us, where we don't have to be either the referees, or we don't have to be the spell checker and school marm over everything that's entered in here. So those are just some concerns that I've got. But I'd like to have a better feel for the workflow, because I guess I'm just anxious about it. So why don't you just continue on? We'll come back to that. And maybe, as I say, by ending a little bit early today, I think you're on page 45.
We are indeed, Chair Butler, and this is actually a good segue into this, because I have stressed really since I took this job that the way to get higher productivity for each FTE is to give them good tools. A person can dig a whole lot more ditch with a backhoe than he can with a shovel. And so we look very carefully at the tools that we lay on, that we hand to our staff. And this page, on page 45, gives you a sense of some of the areas in which we use tools. Benefit calculations and payments. In some cases, we have some very good tools, like the electronic funds transfer system. Very helpful to us. We really encourage members to use it, because it makes paying benefits a lot more effective and economical and productive for us.
How many did you say? What percentage are using EFT?
About 80% is our understanding.
Okay.
Thank goodness my staff is here to help me out with these things. The member employer account balance tracking. This is what I was talking about in terms of the annual reconciliation, because in order to tell a member what he's got in his account or her account, we have to have an accurate understanding of what contributions were made, were they the right contributions, how many months they actually worked. And it's not just account tracking, it's also service time tracking, because remember, we have multiple benefit methodologies, one of which is based on service time, the other is based on a financial account measure. Member estimates. As you know, we've talked about this before. Members, particularly as they begin to approach retirement, start to begin planning when they might be able to financially retire, and they start asking us for estimates. And we have actually a tool. It's part of RIMS. RIMS does all three of the first bullet points: benefit calculations, account balance tracking, and member estimates, and doesn't do any of them terribly well. And that is one of the reasons why in each of these three areas, benefit calculation and account balance tracking and estimates, we have a significant amount of manual work in order to complete those tasks. I'd like to spend a little bit of time on the fourth bullet point, which is document flow. Financial institutions and members, and many of you have constituents that are members, really focus on the financial measures, because that's what really matters. They're thinking about what kind of money am I going to get from the retirement system in terms of the obligations that are owed me. But it turns out that we are a statutory organization, and statutory decisions rest on documentation. And so we have an entire another a part of our information management platform that manages the documents, and the documents are the final arbiter of whether or not somebody worked someplace or somebody didn't, or somebody got some service time or somebody didn't, or a contribution was made or not, or their status is Tier 1 or Tier 2 or not. And our document system is actually more antiquated than our data system, our financial system. We largely rely on microfiche. You know, when you were young and doing, you're quite young now, I'm sure, but when you were younger, and you did work in school and looking up things, you remember the microfiche machine? We use only slightly more improved versions of pictures of documents, most of the intensive record-keeping entities in the private sector have long ago moved to digital documents. We have almost no digital documents in-house, and it takes a lot of manual labor. When we do a transaction, we call down to a small staff of about 8 or 10 people and say, find me the documents associated with this person that may date back 30 years. And so they peruse the microfiche library and find a document here and here and assemble a package in a manila folder and send it upstairs and say, these are the documents that we have about this person who either wants to get a refund or retire or buy some service time. And it is an extraordinarily inefficient and inaccuracy-prone process. Our first major effort to move to modern technology, which is about to be launched and we hope will be completed before the end of the year, is to take one of our processes, the refund process, and to digitize all the documents and make that that one of our 20 or so processes work largely on the basis of digital documents that can be instantly retrieved at the screen by the staff member who's doing the transaction. So
the process that you've just described to us, I'm sitting here thinking about how certainly paper intensive that is, but how absolutely absurd it sounds as well. That's like if I were to make a deposit to the bank of $10,000 4 years ago and then draw checks off of it from then until now, and then go to the bank the day after tomorrow and say, I want my $10,000 that I deposited back, and then they have a burden of proof to come back to me and say, the reason that you don't get your $10,000 is the total of these $8,000 or $9,000 worth of checks that you've written are here, 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 and here, and they would have to explain to me how I had withdrawn that $10,000 over a period of, in my case, just a few years, in your case, over a lifetime. And I question whether or not some of the members don't have some obligation in that process to affirmatively say, yes, that's my account. Yes, that appears to be accurate. Because they get annual statements, do they not?
They do. But Chair Butler, you know, I think of my own circumstance. What was I doing 30 years ago? And
can you remember that for me?
So as we try to be a member-centric organization, that would be a pretty heavy burden to place on members.
We're not talking about 30 years ago. We're talking about the statement that we got in January or February. There's some affirmative responsibility for a member to say that's accurate or that's inaccurate, but we seem to have shifted that entire burden over to this. Again, it sounds like an identical situation I just described to you. Wait a minute, I deposited $10,000 to the bank 4 years ago. You've got to prove to me now. Do you think the bank's going to do that? They're going to say something between no and hell no, because they're going to say, wait a minute, what did you do with your statement that showed that you were drawing out checks every month from that? That's your proof as to, and they may have an affirmative legal obligation to go back and tell me, well, let's see, for the last 60 days, these are the account activity on your account. But they certainly have no legal obligation to go much behind that. Now, I don't know what legal obligation we have here, but it sounds like the same story I'm describing, Jim.
Well, Chair Butler, I appreciate your concern, but our legal obligation is what's in the statute, and the statute is abundantly clear on this.
We must provide hard documents.
That we're supposed to pay the lawful benefit that has been earned by the member, And the member, it would seem to me that that obligation rests on us as acting on behalf of the state and on behalf of our local
employers. So what you're telling me is that the entire series of historic documents, that is not documents, but the cutouts year by year with regard to that must be evidenced then at the termination of, or at the close of employment and the commencement of retirement, must be evidenced by a whole series of hard documents?
There are key documents that the member is obligated to give us and give us accurately. For example, a retirement application that their employer is that required to give us, like an accurate notice of employment and notice of separation. But it would seem as the record-keeping entity that we bear some burden of collecting those documents that detail the beginning and ends and actions that have taken place in a member's career and summing them up and saying, yes, you have earned this kind of benefit. I would be reluctant to even hint that that obligation doesn't rest on our shoulders.
Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what the question I would have is being is that, well, particularly in terms of identifying what the amounts were put into a member's account, theoretical member's account. So you'd actually have to have copies of the original documents from the jurisdictions, or at least what they had transmitted. The question would be is, if they transmit something, you put it into the system, do you still have to have the original document? Or a copy of a microfiche or digital copy thereof?
Chair Butler, Senator Devlin, I'll have my staff correct me if I'm wrong, but we just had a major review with the Archives Department within the last year to go over all of our document retention policies and procedures. And the state's requirement is actually to retain those documents, those particular documents that you referenced, like the beginning and end of a person's working career, for 175 years. So the answer is a strong affirmative to your question.
And the affirmative is the original document or a copy?
It's actually, we have to have one acceptable to the Archives Department that would last for 175 years, and it turns out that they'll accept a clear photograph of the document.
Okay, Senator, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They would accept a digital if you had it, actually. Would they?
Interesting question, Senator Devlin. I'm not at all sure that they would, because they have a view that technology changes over time, and a picture, even if it's on microfiche, is always discernible to the naked eye. We get into archival policies and practices, and you're now into somebody else's expertise. The reason that we're pursuing digital documents is that photographs of documents are really hard to do transactions on. And complete complex processes on, because they're physical in nature and they're difficult to retrieve. Digital documents are instantaneous, and they they make staff members so much more productive. But I'm not sure that the Archives Division would say, for the purposes of 175-year retention, that they would accept digital documents. I wish they would.
Follow-up, Senator?
But the reality would be, let's go away from whether or not they would accept it, actually. I doubt if their requirements are constitutional. So if we change the statute, they could accept whatever the legislature said they would accept. But once you had a digital system in place, would not in some way the cost actually be less than your current cost in terms of retaining paper files, having them converted to microfiche, the time it takes to access those files?
Dramatically less. And God willing, 5 to 7 years from now, with the support of the legislature and some luck and some hard work on our staff's part, we may get to that point.
Okay, Jim, if we're going to have a few minutes, we're going to have to kind of cut on through this.
At your direction, Mr. Chair.
Well, let's see. From here on out, it's technology until we get down to the affirmative action on pages 51 and 52. So if you'll go ahead and speak most of that to Senator Devlin, because Dallas, and I will continue to work with IRMD issues with you.
I realize that that's the way you'd like to proceed, and no problem.
Okay.
So very quickly, I said earlier that that most of the technology expenditures that that we hope to do over this coming biennium will actually be executed on individual project requests through the e-board as we work with IRMD, and that is working smoothly. I'm happy to report. Now, with respect to what is in this budget, this information is in the budget to give you background as to why we are asking in this budget for some additional strengthening of the internal IT department at PERS. And it largely revolves around two issues. One is we need some skilled people to raise our ability to conduct outside projects. We are now aggressively outsourcing much of our programming in order to not have a large permanent programming staff on board. And so what you're seeing is the creation of the project management office with project leads, and they are exercising control over local firms in Oregon who are actually doing programming for us. And in fact, DAS has been extremely helpful in providing access to an umbrella contract that they have with programming resources in the state, and it has allowed us to move away from having to move toward larger internal programming staffs. But it has required us to build up certain levels of expertise in order to make those projects successful. For example, database administration, quality assurance, the head of the project management office, and project leads. And so if you look at the people that we are asking for in this budget, they all revolve largely around those kinds of activities. We're not asking for large numbers of programmers, even though we expect to conduct large numbers of projects. In fact, I believe that, and this is a round number, that as we sit here today, we have 40 separate projects going that are IT or IT-related, some of them very large, some of them very small, all of them being conducted within the discipline of the project management office. So all of the discussion that we have here really goes to two things. One is to try to give you support for the notion of why we're asking for this increment of skilled people in our IT department. And the second is to give you some background as to understand the watershed period that we're at in trying to move away from early 1980s technology, which manifestly is not doing the job and is now creating risk for us rather than support. And in a careful, measured, deliberate, painful fashion, begin to move to new technology. And part of that is to keep this technology alive, because I'm fond of saying that a pension system has no pause button. You know, there are times when you can say, well, let's just stop for 2 or 3 months and sort of gather our wits about us. We can't do that because all of our members, all of our employer participants, their life goes on in terms of transactions they want us to do and record-keeping requirements that continue on in absolutely continuous fashion. So we cannot shut down or pause even for a day without creating really havoc in what is a continuous record-keeping process that really doesn't have a pause button. So those are the two reasons why we've included these pages. I've talked so much about the inadequacy of our technology tools to do the job that I really don't want to beat a dead horse.
Let me ask a question about the telephone. I noticed the telephonic system comes back up here, Jim. Relative to the telephonic system, was that when you had to take a sawzall and whack it out of the old building and move it over so that it cannot be adapted to today's available technologies? Was the building built over cost, or nobody had estimated what it was going to take to put a telephone system at a current technology telephone system?
No, it was a, as I understand it, and I think Mr. Bailey is here, it was a cost, he was the client sponsor of the building, it was a cost-saving measure. We decided to keep the cost of the new building down by reusing every element that we could in the old building, and the phone switch was one of them. And in fairness, I probably hyperbolized a little bit on the metaphor of the sawzall. I wasn't there. But we did extract the switch physically from the building, carry it to the new building, and plug it in. I got carried away, Mr. Chair. I apologize.
My brother does it all the time. I mean, he's scavenging one thing out of a building as we're moving to another.
Well, you know, I think we want to leave the impression, because we think it's true, that we're not trying to spend trust fund dollars willy-nilly. We really are trying to spend them in a way where there's bang for the buck. And, for example, the phone system, we're convinced, will allow us to service more members with the same number of people, or the same number of members with fewer people, or the same number of members better. But we know that the phone system can help. We're going to use a little bit of savings that we had this year to improve the navigation of our website, because, and I'll give you a classic example of how these communication tools can help our productivity, we have enabled our members, moving to the group counseling that the legislature directed us to do, to self-register for these group counseling measures and reduce the number of phone calls to a staff member taking down the names, staff member entering them onto a log of attendees who wish to come to a meeting. We've really moved away from that, and now what we do is we just look at our website and we find out that members have self-registered. Every time we find an opportunity like that, we want to jump on it.
And let's see, voice retrieval, you don't have voice retrieval presently?
We have limited voice retrieval, and what we're talking about is interactive voice command where people can go down a tree. And I know these are frustrating because you probably have had the opportunity to call an airline or something and get directed. And if you want this, press 1. If you want this, press 2. But as irritating as that can be to maybe our members, the fact is those kinds of flexibility in arranging your phone system, which are limited by our current switch, do increase dramatically self-use. Even though it may make people unhappy, they do use it, and it lowers the manual intervention that needs to be done by a staff member.
Does your internet access toggle into an email so that they can, if they've got internet access, they can just email a question? I've found that's the best way to communicate with you folks.
Indeed, that's an excellent question, Representative Butler. That's exactly what we've done, and now we actually find our phone call traffic, while it's still extraordinarily high, it would be much higher had we not done exactly what you say. We have a very substantial email flow, particularly from people who have very complex questions, and it gives us some time, as you know from email, gives us some time to do some research. We come back usually within 24 hours, so the service is pretty good, I think, from looking at it from the member's perspective. And we also can use standardized scripts because, you know, some of these questions get to be pretty familiar. So we have a bank of scripts, and it also allows us to exert supervisory control over what is said to members so that we don't make promises we can't keep, like don't worry about the Lipscomb case, it'll go away. We look at those scripts, and they're reviewed by senior management. So there's a quality aspect, a productivity aspect, and again, we look for places where we can find these opportunities, we jump on them, and if we see something blocking us, like an inadequate phone switch, we come to you and ask for help. And that's the best we can do.
Okay, please continue with the information technology portion there.
When we talk about the technology budget, the technology oversight strategy and the upgrade strategy, I just want to summarize kind of three things. One is that we have to keep the current system alive, and therefore in the capital spending part of it, you're going to see a stream of projects that have to do with what we call RIMS fixes. They just extend the life of the system a little bit longer, but it doesn't stop its degradation and its mismatch with our services, but it allows us to cope a little while longer. You'll see requests for gradual replacement of the RIM system with new technology. And the third thing you'll see is an aggressive activity in terms of joining with IRMD and DAS as a whole on oversight and cooperation. And I want to take a moment here because one of the requests that we have in this budget is for a purchasing or a contracts position. Is that not correct? Let me explain to you why this position is exactly kind of fits the telephone switch metaphor. We, when the OPUS project was terminated a few years ago, a new project structure was put in place because doing nothing, everybody agreed, was not an option. The new project puts us in a position where rather than hiring a general contractor to build our IT house and us oversee it, we are now the general contractor. And what that means is that we went from having three contracts with kind of quality assurance, technology audit, and the general contractor, we went to having dozens and dozens of contracts. Because now it's the same thing as if you were going to build a house yourself, you would be writing contracts with the flooring guy, the heating and ventilation guy, the plumbing guy. You'd be doing what a general contractor does. And so what that has done is two things. One is it emphasized the importance of having the project management office if we're going to be literally being the general contractor of all of these things. And the second thing is that we found that the state process, and we're not arguing against the state process, but it is laborious, and I presume so for a reason, became a very big barrier to moving quickly on these projects. DAS has been extraordinarily helpful in that they've stepped up to the plate, the purchasing department, and agreed to put a single person, a new person in place to service us, and we've agreed to add a contracts person in our operation, which will allow us to move much more quickly on these projects. And we couldn't be more thrilled about this. But being a general contractor and having this multiplicity of contracts requires that if you want to break that logjam, you have to have somebody focused who owns that, who owns the breaking of that logjam every day they come to work. If you don't, if it's the third most important thing that somebody else does, it's going to get the third most attention. And quite frankly, in our current situation, it can't get that little attention. It needs to get more attention. So that's the point that I wanted to make here because it ties directly to one of the one of the permanent FTEs that we are asking in our budget. That really summarizes in very brief form the information technology. We can go into that in more depth if you have questions, and we can conclude if you like. I know you're pressed for time, Chair Butler. Our affirmative action, we do everything we can on this score. We have always been on time with our reports, and we seem to be very close to the general guidelines that are created by the state, so we're pretty pleased with our circumstance.
With that, I'm being called back into another committee, so I'm going to Johnson. We're right close to the end, and I was going to spend a few minutes afterwards on some of the items. I've listed these down. If you wanted to meet with Dallas afterwards, with that, I'll just go ahead and turn the gavel over to Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Please continue at whatever point you are.
Well, we had, Chair Johnson, we had just completed the technology section, and I'd be happy to, that would be in the general overview pages 45 through 51. If you would like to scan those pages before we leave them and see if there are any questions that that pop out, I would be happy to do that.
Thank you. If Chair Butler has written down some questions, we can come back and revisit. Does this conclude your director's report?
It brings us to the retirement program section, which is a much more detailed review of one part of our agency. And again, we can continue on if you like. Another thing we could do is, I don't know if Senator Devlin was here this morning when we reported on the backlog question that arose yesterday. If you would like to, that answer is about 3 minutes long, if you would like to hear it.
If Senator Devlin would indulge me, I would love to hear it.
Okay.
Chair Johnson, the question that came up yesterday was, we have 11 people, limited duration positions, that are targeted at clearing backlogs that have been developing and continue to grow since the early 1990s, some of them. And so we handed a two-page handout out.
Right. I did get that, and I heard the portion of the discussion this morning where you and Representative Patridge had the exchange relative to what your employers can do to be of assistance to you rather than asking you to pick up try to catch errors or try to catch deficiencies in reporting. And I thought that was a useful exchange. I believe you were going to come back with some additional information to the committee.
We are indeed going to do exactly that. And with respect to the backlogs, what we've done here on the second page of this two-page handout is we've delineated both in a pie chart form and in a bar chart form the categories of different kinds of backlogs. Recall that we have many different kinds of transactions and record-keeping requirements. They're not all suffering from backlog problems, but these in particular have been problematic for us. And one of the questions was, how long does it take to clear an average backlog, and what do you intend to accomplish with these 11 limited-duration positions? And that's really on the front page. What we've done is taken three of these backlog categories, three that we think are particularly problematic, and said, let's face off a limited-duration team against these three backlogs, not all the backlogs we have, but these three, and see if we can put them to bed. And as you can see under the first bullet point under each bolded one, each type of backlog we estimate takes a different amount of time to fix. Some of them take 6 hours. Some of them we think can be done in one. And we build up from that to the 11 FTE that we're going to launch with the if the legislature agrees to support this at these backlogs. The only fly in the ointment, which Representative Patridge asked me about, he said, well, these backlogs were set and targeted a year and a quarter ago. Do you think you can actually wipe them out because some of them have grown? And as you can see, just taking the first one, the 6,000 that were backlogged at the time we created this initiative have now grown to 7,400. So the answer is maybe. But we can make a heck of a shot.
Well, that was exactly my question, because as a freshman in the first regular session, which now seems like 500 years ago, yours was one of the early budgets that I heard, and that was 2 years ago, and there was backlogs, and there were cases unresolved. And I thought to myself as I ended up hearing the budget, well, they'll get that fixed in the next 2 years, and now there are more. And I guess what I'm trying to ask is, you've used your best judgment to ascertain that 11 people could clear that backlog. Conversely, it seems on the front end of your system, you're being stressed even more with additional retirements, complexity of the cases. What gives the legislature any assurance that if you had 25 people in there, you were going to clear this?
Excellent question, Chair Johnson, and all I can say, I can respond as Cora did to a very similar question that was posed earlier today, and that is that there are 4.5 FTE in this budget request that are targeted at ongoing operations, that is, the transactions that have the potential for adding new backlog items. And am I absolutely positive that if those 4.5 FTE were approved, that in fact these backlogs would stabilize and then we could attack a fixed target? The answer is no, and the reason is that the surge in current retirements has exceeded the expectations that we had set when we drew up the budget and it was approved by the governor by a wide margin. And Representative Butler has asked us to address that question at the very end of our presentation. In some respects, we're looking at a budget that is targeted as we saw the world roughly a year or so ago. And the world has changed in several very specific requests. The strategy, however, that's in this budget, the targeting of some people on accuracy enhancement, the targeting of people on backlog reduction hasn't changed. But the underlying environment has changed a lot. And do they have Rolling Thunder in their handout?
I don't think we've got it.
I don't want to go crossways with the direction that we got from the chair, but we will be handing out a final page in our handouts, or a final set of documents, that's going to talk about emerging reality, and that is what the budget expectations were and how much they are or are not being exceeded by the current flow of members out of employment and into retirement.
I know you're trying to make your presentation here thoughtfully and reasonably. I guess the thing that keeps striking me is the sense of urgency that ought to be present. You said yesterday that you continued to discharge all of the legislative mandates, and I guess I'm looking for some reassurance that you have worked in as many venues as possible to go through those legislative mandates and see what ones you would recommend to the legislature to change, that you could be proactive in doing that. You're going to be reactive to a whole bunch of initiatives that are going through the system right now. You've got this giant bunch of backlogs, and while I never practiced, I was trained as a lawyer, and I just see lawsuit written all over these. I'm looking for some reassurance that there's a way out of the woods.
Chair Johnson, excellent question, and I don't think you're going to particularly like my answer to the first part of your question, and that is legislative mandates that I would recommend be dropped in order to address the urgency of the situation, the fact that we have a retirement system that is behaving in a way that perhaps the legislature or none of us anticipated that it would. By statute, neither my board nor I can come to you and say you should get rid of a statutory mandate. We are pure policy takers in that respect. We would no more come to you and say you should eliminate the special treatment of wildland firefighters than we would come and tell you the moon is made of blue cheese. We look at the statute, and if it says there are special record-keeping requirements for substitute teachers, then that's what we do. We don't come back to you and say, you shouldn't do this because it makes our life tougher. We would be happy to tell you those categories of mandates that create greater or lesser administrative burden, but, you know, as far as we're concerned, you have given us the policy, and we're running with it.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would fully anticipate that regardless of what happens in this session, litigation will preoccupy your agency, at least for this coming biennium, if not the biennium after that. And I could see clearly why you would not come in and tell the legislature to change a classification that it had changed in the sense of making forest firefighters, police and fire versus general service. But also, one of the things that probably will be needed sometime is a complete, and I'm just speculating here, is a complete cleanup of your statutes in terms of, I mean, one of the things that's often been said to us about the PERS program is that we've added we had a one-bedroom house, and now it has 14 bedrooms and
a big garage.
A big garage.
Cleaning costs are going up.
And I've seen attempts before, which have been successful, to clean up all the banking statutes in the state. So I'm thinking that administratively, if there was something administratively we could do to improve the operation of your agency, I don't see why, unless you are specifically barred from doing that in terms of making recommending to the legislature, I don't see why you wouldn't come forward with administrative changes. I can clearly see why you wouldn't come forward on a policy decision that the legislature had made, whether to cover one class or another class, and what, because that is a policy decision.
Chair Johnson, could I respond to Senator Devlin's
Please.
Question?
Yeah.
Because I think that this is the nut of it. It's not just that we've not been authorized to do so, and I suppose the legislature could instruct the director to do so, but he would not do so under his own initiative. But there are two things that are different than the statute, than most other statutes. One is contract rights. Most of the truly burdensome, administratively burdensome, complex complexities are rooted in grants of special categories to or in the plan structure itself. And it is argued aggressively by member organizations that all of those things, if they have any economic value to a member, they're part of a contract right. You just can't change them. So let me give you an example. We have what's called the 600 hours rule. It's something that has been in the statute for 56 years, and it is so controversial and so administratively complex, we have yet to be able to succeed in getting a consensus among our stakeholders to write a rule for it. You raised earlier the question of substitute teachers. This is an administrative nightmare for us because they work concurrently in several different jurisdictions. All those jurisdictions say, well, I only had the person for 120 hours, or I only had them for 300 hours.
When they exceed 600 hours.
But when they exceed 600 hours, they are obligated, they believe, under contract to get PERS treatment. And then what happens is that if we have to investigate it manually, assemble the hours manually, figure out that they have eligibility manually, then recalculate all the contributions that were owed on that past service manually, and then send out bills to the school districts, which raises their ire to no end. So that's an example of, you could go in there and I could say, you know, if we got rid of the 600 hours rule in the statute, it would really make a material difference. But there are probably a 500 or 1,000 student teachers and their representing organizations that would say, no way. This is a benefit obligation. And most of the things that would make a huge difference immediately engage the issue of, these are perceived or actual, or however you want to look at it, benefits that members believe they are entitled to. So that's the dilemma that we're in.
So, Madam Chair.
Chair, Senator Devlin, and then
not that I would want to be part of this at all.
That's a courageous process.
So if we needed to basically look at the entire system, I mean, going away from all these issues about reform in the system, simply look at the system from an administrative standpoint of how we could simplify, it probably would be something best for the legislature to approach, in a sense, and basically call the stakeholders in, just as they're trying to do over restructuring the system now.
Chair Johnson, Representative, or Senator Devlin, the legislature is actually doing precisely that, but focused on a different target. If you notice the discussions that are going on about a successor system, there is a tremendous emphasis among all the people who have brought forward plans, including the member organizations that have brought forward draft successor plans, on far greater simplicity. Far greater simplicity. So in some respects, you can look at what those draft plans don't have and what is in the current system, and you have your list of things that are adding complexity. I'll give you an example. Representative McPherson has brought forward a hybrid plan that said, and his view is, disability should not be part of a retirement system. Disability protection is a separate issue and should be addressed separately in an insurance mechanism that isn't embedded in the pension system. And that is dramatically 180 degrees different than our current system. And as you know, we have a substantial number of staff, a substantial number of record-keeping requirements, a substantial number of contested case flows that are associated exclusively with disability. So there's the legislature is, in fact, going through that discussion, but sort of in a slightly different venue. Sorry for the length of that answer.
No problem.
Dallas. Yeah, I have a question, Madam Chair. Going back to the substitute teacher example, and this is an issue that I've been grappling with, is that what makes your responsibility to go back and recalculate and then assess every prior employer when schools are pooled for rate purposes. Is that by statute or is that by administrative rule?
I believe, Mr. Wine, that's by statute because we are obligated to assess the costs of providing a pension to the employers who receive the service.
Mr. Voitko, respectfully, you have staff who looks like they're going to pop out of their skin. May I invite you up to the table?
Madam Chair.
What the director meant to say
The director is correct.
Before you correct your director, would you state your name for the record?
For the record, Steve Delaney, PERS Legislative Liaison. Yes, Dallas, it's the pertaining contributions. It's the statutory requirement that an employer shall pay all contributions approved by the member, and there's no statute of limitations on that, so therefore we have to go back all the way.
And can I follow up, Mr. Wynan?
I guess it goes back to pooled rates. Can that be construed to be payment of the required contributions as opposed to going back? Because there's an extreme administrative burden placed on the system. I just want to make it very clear that I understand it's because of the statutes, but maybe that's the avenue versus administrative rule to clear that up.
And if I could, Dallas, the answer is that the pooled rate is the price, but the service rendered times the price, or in this case, the salary earned times the price, is the employer's obligation. So that's my best answer to your question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Johnson. With that, we're going to go ahead and close today's hearing on Senate Bill 5538, Public Employee Retirement System.